while those are coming in, kind of straggling behind. I'd like to welcome everybody to this session of the Sunstone Symposium, featuring Mike Quinn. And his topic today is going to be Ezra Taft Benson, an LDS Church Conflict, 1950s through 1980s. Dr. Quinn received his Ph.D. at Yale University, taught at BYU. He's now a freelance scholar and independent writer. His publications include, at least among LDS areas, include such books as J. Reuben Clark, The Church Years, and Early Mormonism and the Magic World View. Various articles that he has done have included subjects all the way from succession in the presidency to conscientious objection and post-manifesto marriage. I'm sure a lot of you in here are familiar with quite a few of them. There are three articles that are slated to come out shortly that I wanted to make you aware of, that I'm rather excited about. I'm sure you will be too. The first one is 150 Years of Truth and Consequences About Mormon History. It should be published in the current Sunstone. I understand it's being current issue is being sold out here. And the next one is Mormon Women Have Had the Priesthood Since 1843. That's going to be a part of a chapter in a book that Signature is coming out with called Women and Authority. And the third article that will be part of a book is entitled Plural Marriage and Mormon Fundamentalism. And that's coming out in a book entitled Fundamentalisms and Society, which is going to be by the University of Chicago Press. This is a part of a series that is sponsored by the Academy of Arts and Sciences. When Dr. Quinn is through, there'll be some comments made by Cheryl May. She received her Ph.D. in International Politics, Tufts University, and she is the head of the public communications for the Utah court system. So without any further ado, we'll turn the time over to Dr. Quinn.
In 1943, Ezra Taft Benson became a member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. From 1951 to 1961, he served as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture to U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Soon after Apostle Benson returned to Utah in 1961, he became involved in a well-known conflict with senior members of the Mormon hierarchy. At issue was Ezra Taft Benson's anti-communist crusade and his unrelenting effort to obtain or imply LDS Church endorsement of the John Birch Society. Excuse me. Apostle Benson described the John Birch Society, which was organized in December 1958, as, quote, the most effective non-church organization in our fight against creeping socialism and godless communism, unquote. He added, quote, I know their leaders. I have attended two of their all-day council meetings. I have read their literature. I feel I know their program, unquote. On the other hand, the John Birch Society was described as, quote, ultra-conservative, unquote, by Democratic liberals and moderates, by Republican moderates, and even by such well-known political conservatives as Barry Goldwater, William F. Buckley, and Russell Kirk. As early as December 1961, the politically conservative president of Brigham Young University, Ernest L. Wilkinson, noted that Apostle Benson was privately criticizing, quote, the socialistic tendencies, unquote, of First Presidency Counselor Hugh B. Brown. Wilkinson added that the two general authorities were already in a, quote, vigorous dispute about anti-communism. That same month, Apostle Benson had publicly warned that, quote, the internal threat to the American way of life is in the secret alliance which exists between the more advanced social democrats and the hardcore communist conspiracy, unquote. Prior to this talk, he also told reporters that current U.S. President John F. Kennedy was, quote, very soft in dealing with the communist threat, unquote. In fact, this conflict between Counselor Hugh B. Brown and Apostle Ezra Taft Benson became a running battle within the Mormon hierarchy. In rebuttal to the publicity of Apostle Benson's remark, the remarks the previous December, Second Counselor Brown instructed General Priesthood Meeting in April 1962, quote, let us not undermine our government or accuse those who hold office of being soft on communism, unquote. Those rebutted words reflected the newspaper accounts of Apostle Benson's December 1961 talk. Because of this Brown-Benson dispute, BYU's President Wilkinson told President McKay in June 1962 that, quote, President Brown is giving aid and comfort to the enemies of what should be sound basic Mormon philosophy, unquote. In October 1962, First Counselor Henry D. Moyle said that Second Counselor Hugh B. Brown spoke to a Democratic convention in Utah only because, quote, Brother Benson had given a political tirade that needed answering, unquote. Counselor Brown himself wrote privately in November 1962 that he was, quote, disgusted, unquote, by Apostle Benson's political activities, and if they didn't cease, quote, some disciplinary action should be taken, unquote. In October 1962, Apostle Benson's son Reed became coordinator for the John Birch Society in Utah, and its Utah membership tripled in the next 6 months. In October 1963, Reed Benson also became coordinator for the Mormon counties of southern Idaho, and he became the Birch coordinator of Washington, D.C. in 1964. Meanwhile, Ezra Taft Benson unsuccessfully tried to get President McKay's approval for the non-Mormon president of the Birch Society to become a speaker at a session of LDS General Conference. Failing that, Apostle Benson endorsed the John Birch Society during his talks at state conferences and preached the Birch platform in his General Conference sermons. In fact, Ezra Taft Benson's official biographer calculated that, quote, from 1960 through 1969, 15 of his 20 General Conference addresses focused on one or more of these political topics, unquote. Other general authorities did not want the John Birch Society or its philosophy to be seen as a measure of one's faith. However, Ezra Taft Benson skillfully created a public environment which left the first presidency and his fellow apostles only five difficult options: remain silent, or privately rebuke Apostle Benson, or publicly endorse his views, or publicly repudiate his views without naming him, or publicly repudiate him by name. On various occasions, the hierarchy adopted each of the five possible responses to Apostle Ezra Taft Benson's political crusade. In January 1963, the first presidency broke its silence. Their announcement stated, quote, we deplore the presumption of some politicians, especially officers, coordinators, and members of the John Birch Society who undertake to align the church or its leadership with their political views, unquote. This was a not too subtle reference to Apostle Benson's son Reed, the Birch coordinator, who was among the Society's few authorized spokesmen. 3 days after the first presidency announcement, Apostle Benson spoke at a rally endorsed by the John Birch Society in Boston. Newspapers reported this as a defiant embarrassment to the LDS Church. After 25 Mormon members of the John Birch Society complained to the presidency about its statement, David O. McKay, always sensitive to criticism, feared that, quote, the first presidency probably went a little too far, unquote. On the other hand, his second counselor felt the presidency's January 1963 statement had not gone far enough. In March 1963, Hugh B. Brown told reporters that Apostle Benson was not, quote, entitled to say the church favors the John Birch Society, unquote. Counselor Brown added that, quote, we, the first presidency, are opposed to them and their methods, unquote. Less than 2 weeks later, Apostle Benson published an acknowledgement that his support of the Birch Society was, quote, my personal opinion only, unquote. Benson's statement went on to quote the church president as being, quote, opposed to anyone using the John Birch Society, opposed to anyone using the church for purposes of increasing membership of the John Birch Society or any other communist, anti-communist organizations. Ezra Taft Benson was obviously under orders from the first presidency to publish this March 1963 statement. Aside from the second counselor's well-known criticism, 2 months after Benson's statement, first counselor Henry D. Moyle said Apostle Benson, quote, just didn't have any reason, unquote, in his anti-communist crusade. Ezra Taft Benson's March 1963 disclaimer was contrary to his efforts before and after that date to align the church with the John Birch Society. By March 1963, most Utah members of the church knew that Apostle Ezra Taft Benson was at the center of a controversy with at least one member of the first presidency. This disturbed church members who were accustomed to reassurances of the harmony and unity among general authorities. Public evidence of this conflict was especially confusing to Mormons who were members or supporters of the John Birch Society. 6 months later, Apostle Benson gave a talk in Los Angeles praising the Birch Society's founder, Robert Welch. Welch had just published a book accusing former U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower of being, quote, a dedicated, conscious agent of the communist conspiracy, unquote. And Ezra Taft Benson publicly implied endorsement of that allegation. Privately, Apostle Benson had already sent copies of Welch's anti-Eisenhower book to general authorities like Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith. Ezra Taft Benson's public praise for the Birch president brought the church controversy into national attention during September 1963. An LDS congressman from Idaho publicly condemned the apostle. Representative Ralph R. Harding told Congress in September that Ezra Taft Benson used his apostleship to give an untrue impression that the LDS church and its people, quote, approve of the John Birch Society. Dwight Eisenhower then entered the Mormon controversy by praising the congressman's criticism of the former president's cabinet member. Ezra's support of the John Birch Society was now a national issue. Apostle Ezra Taft Benson next used the October 1963 General Conference to defy his Mormon critics. Right after Hubie Brown was sustained as first counselor, Apostle Benson's General Conference sermon relayed a covert subtext to both his supporters and detractors. On the surface, the talk simply referred to the excommunication of early church leaders and warned of the need to detect error today. BYU's Wilkinson felt the talk actually referred to Apostle Benson's, quote, running controversy with President Brown, quote, who also recognized Ezra's subtext. Quote, I don't think I'm going to be excommunicated, the new first counselor said privately right after the conference session ended. Wilkinson saw this as further evidence of the animosity between Hubie Brown and Ezra Taft Benson. Quote, the feeling is very intense between them, unquote. Then Apostle Benson went on to urge his LDS clients to, quote, come to the aid of anti-communist patriots, programs, and organizations, unquote. 3 weeks later, the First Presidency announced that they were assigning Apostle Benson to preside over the European mission in December. The media immediately described this as a reprisal or exile for Apostle Benson's virtual endorsement of the John Birch Society at General Conference. This 1963 foreign mission added to the controversy swirling around Ezra Taft Benson. He told reporters that the assignment was not a rebuke. President McKay eventually released an official denial that the mission was, quote, because of Elder Benson's alleged activities with the John Birch Society, unquote. However, leaders at church headquarters revealed that the intent of this mission was to remove Apostle Benson from the American political mainstream and scene. President McKay's son and secretary was the first to indicate Benson's mission was a censure. On the same day, his father privately told Apostle Benson of the mission assignment. Robert McKay wrote to the Idaho congressman who had publicly criticized Benson, quote, we shall all be relieved when Elder Benson ceases to resist counsel and returns to a concentration on those affairs befitting his office. It is my feeling that there will be an immediate and noticeable curtailment of his Birch Society activities. Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith then identified Apostle Benson's mission as intentional exile. The Quorum of Twelve's president wrote to the same LDS congressman on October 30th that Apostle Benson, quote, is going to take a mission to Europe in the near future, and by the time he returns, I hope he will get all of the political notions out of his system, unquote. By the eve of Ezra Taft Benson's departure for Europe in December 1963, the controversy's bitterness was public property. Some rank-and-file Mormons threatened to picket Apostle Benson's farewell talk at the LDS Tabernacle in Logan, Utah, because his remarks, quote, will most likely be an attempt again to build up the John Birch Society, unquote. When stake leaders, quote, became skittish, unquote, about letting him use the tabernacle for this talk, Apostle Benson said he would, quote, hold the meeting in a tent if need be, unquote. In his parting message at the Logan Tabernacle, Apostle Benson said that the U.S. government was becoming so communistic that American citizens, quote, can resist communist tyranny only by themselves becoming conspirators against the established government, unquote. As for the mission call itself, at a church farewell on December 14th, Reed Benson said that his father had been stabbed in the back, unquote. Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith listened to that remark and wrote 9 days later, quote, I am glad to report to you that it will be some time before we hear anything from Brother Benson, who is now on his way to Great Britain, where I suppose he will be at least for the next 2 years. When he returns, I hope his blood will be purified, unquote. After the newspapers printed that caustic assessment, the Quorum of Twelve's president made a public disclaimer which actually verified the political motivations for Benson's assignment to Europe. Quote, "I meant that when he returned, he would be free of all political ties," unquote. The hierarchy overestimated the foreign mission's moderating influence on Apostle Benson's political zeal. While on that mission, Elder Benson authorized the John Birch Society to publish his photograph for the cover of its magazine in October 1964. In April 1965, Elder Benson visited Utah to address General Conference. Quote, "Before I left for Europe, I warned how the communists were using the civil rights movement to promote revolution and eventual takeover of this country. When are we going to wake up? Now, brethren, the Lord has never promised there would not be traitors in the church. We have the ignorant, the sleepy, and the deceived, who provide temptations and avenues of apostasy for the unwary and the unfaithful," unquote. The last section was reminiscent of Elder Benson's negative allusion to Counselor Hubie Brown at the October 1963 conference. The official publication of April 1965 conference talks deleted Elder Benson's new reference to LDS traitors, as well as his assessment of the civil rights movement as communist and revolutionary. In December 1965, President McKay's secretary, Claire Middlemiss, endorsed Apostle Benson's continued anti-communist crusade. She wrote a church member, quote, "President McKay has further instructed me to tell you that Elder Ezra Taft Benson has not been rebuked by the church, and since communism is a definite threat to the eternal principle of free agency, it cannot be considered that he is, quote, out of line, unquote, when discussing it in his talks," end of quote. However, later that month, other general authorities vetoed an effort by one of Elder Benson's intermediaries to have the John Birch Society's president speak at BYU. Those voting against the proposal were Apostles Joseph Fielding Smith, Harold B. Lee, Delbert L. Stapley, Marion G. Romney, and LeGrand Richards. That unanimous vote reflected Presidency Counselor N. Eldon Tanner's statement to a political science professor, quote, "We certainly don't want the John Birch Society to get a hold on the BYU campus," unquote. In February 1966, Ezra Taft Benson spoke about the John Birch Society to a standing room only crowd at the Salt Lake Temple Square. He recommended that the audience subscribe to the Birch Society's official magazine, American Opinion. Of his support for the Birch Society, the Deseret News added Apostle Benson's comment to the Mormons on Temple Square, quote, "It has been very unpopular to defend this group," he said, "but I can remember when it was unpopular to defend my own church," unquote. Such equations of the John Birch Society with the LDS Church were part of what antagonized general authorities like Hubie Brown, N. Eldon Tanner, Joseph Fielding Smith, Harold B. Lee, and Mark E. Peterson against Apostle Benson. To provide a context for the hierarchy's negative reactions to Elder Ezra Taft Benson's 1966 activities, the evaluations of two of his Mormon supporters is helpful. BYU's president, Ernest L. Wilkinson, had already attended 3 days of private indoctrination by the president of the John Birch Society. And Wilkinson resolved, quote, "to press forward with more training along this line at the BYU," unquote. Fellow conservative W. Cleon Skousen had already published a defense of the John Birch Society and was an official speaker for the Birch Society in 1966, even though he was not formally a member of the organization. In April 1966, Wilkinson and Skousen conversed about the John Birch Society, quote, pardon me, "we would probably agree with 90% of their principles, but we both believe that Ezra Taft Benson has made some tactical or procedural errors in trying to vouch President McKay in on everything he has done," unquote. These reservations by Apostle Benson's ardent Mormon supporters give better perspective for the position of those general authorities who did not share his views about the John Birch Society. The BYU president's reference to Ezra Taft Benson's, quote, "tactical errors," unquote, involved the apostles' coordinated effort to align the LDS Church with the John Birch Society during the April 1966 General Conference. Early in the year, Apostle Benson got President McKay's permission for Benson to introduce the Birch Society president as a keynote speaker in the church's Hotel Utah during General Conference. Then Apostle Benson arranged for the church president's photograph to appear on the cover of the April issue of the John Birch Society's official magazine. In March, the Birch magazine sent a letter to all its Utah subscribers that its upcoming cover photograph of President McKay was intended, quote, "to favorably impress your Mormon friends," unquote. On March 8th, the chairman of the Welch dinner meeting also mailed a Dear Brethren letter to stake presidents and bishops, inviting them to attend, quote, with your counselors and wives, unquote. By the time the first presidency learned of the dinner arrangements and Elder Ezotap Benson's plan for the church president's photograph, they defined the situation as, quote, a crisis, unquote. In an emergency meeting of 15 March 1966 with Second Counselor N. Olden Tanner, Quorum President Joseph Fielding Smith, and Apostle Mark E. Peterson, quote, President McKay suggested that Elder Benson might not be assigned to state conferences if he referred to the John Birch Society. The president then said that Elder Benson should be instructed not to discuss the Birch Society in any meeting and that he should not advocate this group, unquote. First Counselor Hubie Brown was not present at this meeting to express his views or to direct its outcome. 2 days later, the First Presidency published a denial of any sponsorship of the Welch dinner or any connection with the John Birch Society. President McKay stopped the publication of his photograph in the Birch magazine and also withdrew his permission for Ezotap Benson to introduce the president of the John Birch Society at its meeting during April conference. Undeterred, Apostle Benson had the Birch magazine print a photograph of deceased First Counselor J. Reuben Clark. Elder Benson attended the Birch Society dinner in April 1966 without speaking, even though his name was on the program as a speaker. Instead, Robert Welch's talk praised Apostle Benson as, quote, one of the really great men of our times, unquote. Welch also said the John Birch Society regarded Mormons, quote, as a very good recruiting ground, unquote. To counter that perception, President McKay at the emergency council meeting on March 15th had authorized one of Benson's opponents in the Quorum of 12 to publicly attack the John Birch Society. Apostle Mark E. Peterson, widely known as the unsigned editorial writer for the Deseret News Church News section, wrote an editorial which proclaimed that the LDS Church has, quote, nothing to do with Birchers, nothing to do with any slanted group, unquote. This 1966 editorial further warned Mormons, quote, to avoid extremes and extremists, unquote. The response of Mormon members of the John Birch Society was predictably negative, and one even asked for Elder Peterson to make an apology. Instead of an apology, Apostle Harold B. Lee continued the anti-Birch assault during April 1966 General Conference. He was Apostle Benson's equally determined critic in the Quorum of the Twelve. In response to recent events, Apostle Lee's conference talk was a thinly veiled assault against the John Birch Society. Apostle Lee said, quote, we hear vicious attacks on public officials without an opportunity being given them to make a defense or a rebuttal to the evil diatribes and character assassinations, unquote. He added, quote, that the sowing of the seeds of hatred, suspicion, and contention in any organization is destructive of the purposes of life and unbecoming to the children of God, unquote. Even more stunning to the Utah audience aware of the controversy, Apostle Lee's general conference talk also publicly criticized Apostle Benson. Without naming his apostolic subordinate, Elder Lee next told April 1966 conference, quote, I would that all who were called to high places in the church would determine, as did the apostle to the Gentiles, to know and preach nothing save Jesus Christ and him crucified, unquote. Then Apostle Lee darkly added, quote, the absolute test of the divinity of the calling of any officer in the church is this. Is he in harmony with the brethren of that body to which he belongs? When we are out of harmony, we should look to ourselves first to find the way to unity, unquote. Apostles Joseph Fielding Smith, Harold B. Lee, and Mark E. Peterson had already indicated that Apostle Ezotap Benson was not in harmony with his quorum. Apostle Harold B. Lee concluded his April 1966 conference with a devastating assessment of the unnamed Ezotap Benson. Quote, a president of the church has told us where we may expect to find false leaders. First, the hopelessly ignorant, whose lack of intelligence is due to their indolence and sloth, Elder Lee noted. Then he continued, second, the proud and self-vaunting ones, who read by the lamp of their own conceit, who interpret by rules of their own contriving, who have become a law unto themselves, and so pose as the sole judges of their own doings, unquote. That was far more a direct condemnation of Ezotap Benson than Apostle Benson's excommunication allusion to Hubie Brown at General Conference less than 3 years before. Counselor Brown had immediately recognized the personal reference in Elder Benson's remarks on that occasion, and Ezra was no less astute as he listened to Harold B. Lee's April 1966 talk. Nevertheless, Apostle Benson simply shrugged off criticism from his fellow apostles. President McKay's address at that conference left church members, quote, free to participate in non-church meetings which are held to warn people of the threat of communism, unquote. In Elder Benson's eyes, this was a personal vindication by the only church leader who mattered. Ezra Taft Benson continued to preach the John Birch message at LDS meetings. Elder Benson also preached at the John Birch political philosophy at Brigham Young University's devotional meetings. For example, in his talk to BYU Devotional in May 1968, Apostle Benson accused the U.S. Supreme Court of treason and said that, quote, a prerequisite for appointment to high government office today is one's past affiliation with communist fronts or one's ability to follow the communist line, unquote. Ezra Taft Benson's address to BYU students also quoted three times from the John Birch Society's official magazine, including references to, quote, black Marxists, unquote, and, quote, the communists and their black power fanatics, unquote. The father of one BYU student complained to the first presidency in May 1968 that Apostle Benson had turned BYU's devotionals, quote, into a sounding board for vicious political interests, unquote. First Counselor Hubie Brown replied, quote, we have had many such letters protesting the speech made at the BYU recently, and we are trying to offset and curtail such expressions, unquote. A week later, Counselor Brown delivered a BYU commencement address, which was a direct attack on Ezra Taft Benson's sermon there only 10 days earlier. Quote, beware of those who feel obliged to prove their own patriotism by calling into question the loyalty of others, unquote, Hubie Brown began. As a clear response to Apostle Benson's quotes to BYU students about African Americans from the Birch Society magazine, Counselor Brown concluded, quote, at a time when radicals of right or left would inflame race against race, avoid those who preach evil doctrines of racism, unquote. Counselor Brown barely concealed his personal antagonism for Ezra Taft Benson in such rebuttal sermons. He continued to offset Apostle Benson's political talks at BYU by following him with rebuttal sermons. While that gave grim satisfaction to some liberals, BYU's Ernest Wilkinson expressed a sentiment shared by Mormons of various places, quote, if President McKay was vigorous enough to do it, I'm sure he would call both of them in and have a talk to them about this, especially President Brown for his critical personal allusions, unquote. Nothing in the generation since the 1960s can compare to the apostolic conflict involving Ezra Taft Benson. Both supporters and detractors emphasized his church office as Apostle Benson continued to promote the John Birch Society until the death of amiable church president David O. McKay. Apostle Benson did not actually mention the Birch Society in his private meetings with President McKay, but merely asked permission to speak about freedom. In Ezra Taft Benson's thinking, there was no distinction between the principles of freedom and the teachings of the John Birch Society. He sincerely felt he had, quote, a mandate from the prophet, unquote, for all his political speeches. On the other hand, First Counselor Hubie Brown regarded Apostle Benson's private meetings with President McKay as manipulative. There is no question that Elder Ezra Taft Benson made what LDS authorities called, quote, end runs around the Quorum of the Twelve and Presidency Counselors in order to obtain David O. McKay's encouragement. However, Hubie Brown's perspective on this lobbying was itself a partisan overstatement. President Benson's amenability to Ezra Taft Benson's right, excuse me, President McKay's amenability to Ezra Taft Benson's right-wing politics was not simply a result of the church president's physical and mental decline. Less than a year after the organization of the John Birch Society, President McKay told General Conference, quote, the conflict between communism and freedom is the problem of our times. It overshadows all other problems. This conflict mirrors our age, its toils, its tensions, its troubles, and its tasks. On the outcome of this conflict depends the future of mankind, unquote. From that perspective, by the president of the church, there was no extremism in Ezra Taft Benson's campaign against what he perceived as communist ideology and influence in America. However, as soon as the John Birch Society became an LDS controversy in 1961, President McKay felt torn between his strong anti-communist convictions and his desire to avoid entanglement of the LDS church with organized anti-communism. Both Ezra Taft Benson and his opponents in the hierarchy played upon that ambivalence in President McKay. Nevertheless, Apostle Benson's political activism went into decline following David O. McKay's death in 1970. His successors as church president were two apostles who had privately and publicly expressed their criticism of Ezra Taft Benson. In 1970, Harold B. Lee began his service as first counselor to Joseph Fielding Smith and was the dominant voice of that administration. They both severely restricted Apostle Benson's political activism. Ernest L. Wilkinson and Apostle Benson both indicated the frustration felt by Mormon ultra-conservatives during the Smith-Lee presidency. BYU's president complained to Apostle Benson in April 1971 about not being able to establish, quote, a chapter of the John Birch Society on our campus, unquote. In 1972, Ezra Taft Benson encouraged General Conference listeners to read None Dare Call It Conspiracy, which was written by an editor of the John Birch Society's official magazine. The first presidency had that admonition deleted from the official report of Apostle Benson's conference talk. 3 months later, President Joseph Fielding Smith died, followed in another 17 months by the unexpected death of President Harold B. Lee. Shortly after amiable Spencer W. Kimball became church president in December 1973, Apostle Benson's political crusade reemerged. After all, he was now president of the 12 and next in line to become LDS president. However, Apostle Benson's resurgent activism was unsuccessful during 1975 in obtaining approval for the John Birch Society's president to be a speaker at BYU. After a string of talks which echoed the John Birch Society's platform, Ezra Taft Benson spoke in September 1976 at the dedication of W. Cleon Skousen's ultra-conservative Freeman Institute, later called the National Center for Constitutional Studies. Former BYU President Ernest Wilkinson gave the invocation at the dedication, and the undercurrent in these meetings was the John Birch Society. D. Arthur Haycock, the church president's secretary, confided to Wilkinson on this day at these ceremonies that, quote, nearly all of them, the general authorities, believed in the concepts of the John Birch Society, quote, unquote. That may have been an overstatement, but more importantly showed that the John Birch Society, and Ezra Taft Benson in particular, had a partisan friend within President Kimball's office. Haycock had been private secretary to Apostle Benson as Secretary of Agriculture. I'm going to skip to the end. However, by the time Ezra Taft Benson himself became church president in 1985, he no longer acted as a standard bearer of the anti-communist movement. After all, at 86, President Benson was the second to become LDS church president and already had dizzy spells, memory loss, and difficulty in public speaking. Besides, the political passions of the 1960s had died and the John Birch Society was quiescent. Ezra Taft Benson's ascension occurred in the middle of America's conservative Reagan Revolution, which the church president saw as a personal vindication. Church officials insisted that Ezra Taft Benson's political activism was, quote, in the past, unquote. 6 months later, the Salt Lake Tribune noted that, quote, President Benson's fiery conservatism remains quiet, unquote. Mormon members of the John Birch Society also felt personal vindication in Ezra Taft Benson's ascendancy as LDS church president. On the other hand, many faithful Latter-day Saints had opposed Apostle Benson for the 3 decades of his John Birch Society activism. Ezra Taft Benson himself had publicly announced how one could disagree with one's supreme file leader and still loyally sustain such a leader. Quote, the American people can respect their president, pray for their president, even have a strong affection for him, and still have an honest difference of opinion as to the merits of some of his program, unquote, President Benson once preached. As an apostle, Ezra Taft Benson had even publicly dissented from the program of his file leaders in the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency. In 1989, Republican President George Bush awarded the Presidential Citizens Medal to Ezra Taft Benson. This was another personal vindication of Ezra's decades of political activism. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I think this is the point where I'm supposed to say I'm happy to be here. I would much rather trade places with any number of people I see here in this auditorium who I think could do this job better than I could. But in a weak moment, I consented to fill this slot, so I will proceed. I first want to express my personal appreciation to Mike for documenting this important conflict, this important drama in the modern history of the church, because a number of authorized biographies, the overwhelming majority, have either failed to treat it at all or very greatly slighted it. And the idea that one can diminish or eliminate the impact of a very important episode by ignoring it or pretending that it wasn't important, I think is dangerous. And there are many of us who still have the imprint of this conflict on our lives and thoughts and feelings. And I believe that for the long-range good of all of us and the church that we love, that it's important to deal openly with it. Let me begin by taking some of you younger folks back, some of the rest of us, to the world that some of us knew, some of us a little older people knew as we were growing up in America in the 50s and 60s. We had been through, this country had been through the trauma of World War II and finally overcoming the horror of Nazi totalitarianism, only to be faced virtually immediately by the horror of communist totalitarianism, and a communism that seemed to be marching confidently and successfully forward on every front. They had taken over all this these multitude of countries in Eastern Europe, had the firm hold on the Soviet Union, were taking over China, North Korea, Cuba, you know, on and on. And it seemed like all we had fought for in terms of freedom and truth were what was being overcome by the forces of lies and the forces of oppression and captivity. And I had a reason, as I was going over some old papers a few years ago, to look at a term paper I had written as a junior in high school called The Mightiest War, about our lack of sufficient preparedness in the face of the communist challenge. And boy, I was right there with John Kennedy when he was running for office and talked about this terrible missile gap that we had with the communists, and that we had to arm ourselves more and we had to prepare ourselves more, and that we simply weren't vigilant enough against this terrible threat. And so this was very shocking and disturbing. And for some of you who have come of political age in very recent years, you might not have a realization of just how horrible the communist threat and the communist reality was. The impact, the humanity-crushing impact of the system of communist totalitarianism that takes away accountability, that takes away the motivation to work, that takes away human dignity, that takes away creativity, that takes away the freedom to worship, and I could go on down the list. We're talking about a serious threat here. And there were very, very few in this country, I think, who did not realize the seriousness of this threat. And as it seemed to march forward, the communist economies at that time seemed to be doing well, politically, militarily, every way, ideologically, they seemed to be doing so well, in spite of the best efforts of the freedom-loving Americans. There were some who said, something must be very wrong. And indeed, what's wrong must be some kind of internal conspiracy. You know, surely, if we're doing everything so right, and they represent so much that's wrong, that it's got to be an internal conspiracy that is making everything go the wrong way. And we have these sort of waves of rightist reaction coming in the 50s and 60s. The McCarthyism wave of, 51 through 54 or so, and then we got, another wave sort of with Wallace and those toward the end of the 60s. And this was this kind of response. People were bewildered and thinking, my gosh, there's got to be some great internal conspiracy. And yet others who opposed communism, and this is the great majority, were saying, no, the way we've got to fight this communism, because the major threat of communism isn't in America, it's in communist countries, and we have to fight it with more freedom, more justice, more opportunity, and standing more consistently for what we believe in. Well, these waves of rightist reaction would cause a lot of excitement at the time, but they were always checked. And they never really took over the majority of the thought of the majority of Americans. And I think that a major reason for this is that, in addition to the horrors of communism, before that the horrors of Nazism, that we Americans, in the experience of World War II and post-World War II, also learned about propaganda. Word we didn't know much about at all before World War II, but we knew how the Nazis did it, we knew how the communists were doing it, and that they used outright falsehoods, they take quotes out of context and totally turn around the meaning, they would have sweeping conclusions based on scant or trumped up information, they would use rumor, innuendo, all kinds of unfair methods for twisting the truth to what they wanted it to be, for turning history inside out so that it accommodated their views. George Orwell wrote a book called 1984 and used the term doublespeak in talking about how perniciously evil this propaganda was. And it seemed like when these rightists would go to the extremes, every single time they start using these propaganda methods in terms of verification of their positions, and Americans had enough sophistication that even if they might, there might be an immediate appeal, it would start wearing away pretty fast. And they say, wait a minute, they are using the very methods that we're supposed to be fighting, they're representing the opposite of what America's supposed to stand for. As an undergraduate at BYU, I learned these lessons well about the nature of this kind of propaganda and about the methods that had to be used for political or historical inquiry to have honesty and integrity. And I learned that while it's absolutely true that our constant search for political and historical truth could never actually arrive at totally objective historical truth. We had too many internal biases to make that completely possible. But that in no way excused us from using every possible method to honestly verify what we were claiming to be historically true. Mike talks in his paper about the impact of Apostle Benson's claims to that all church members should follow the Birch Society, and the objection that he received from the great majority of the members of the 12 and the first presidency to these claims, and that the members of the Birch Society found this disillusioning. I wanted to mention that there were many of the rest of us who also found, when an apostle of the Lord started supporting openly and repeatedly the kind of literature like the Blue Book or Welch's The Politician or the American Opinion articles that used every one of these scurrilous propaganda techniques, and said that the president that this apostle had worked with for 8 years in the Eisenhower administration was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy during all that time, as were all the members of the Supreme Court, as were all the leaders of the civil rights movement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that many of us were disillusioned and confused and dismayed and wondered how to reconcile this with our faith in what we always thought was a unified set of general authorities. In terms of lessons from this fine study, the impact on the brethren, since we're not privy to the meetings of the 12 and what went on in them during this great period of acrimony and animosity, it's hard to say for sure what kind of negative impact this might have had within the 12. We know that the period of the 60s and 70s into the 80s was a period of explosive growth in the church, a period when many new and successful programs were initiated. And one in which surely even the brethren might have learned that there were some values even more important than unity when an extremist threat such as that presented by Apostle Benson at the time presented itself. an observation about the role of the prophet during this period. Clearly, it seems like from Mike's study, when a prophet is ambivalent or when a prophet is disabled, you get sort of a hydra situation where you really have many heads and many spokespeople for the church, and it can be very confusing. And when you have a prophet who has an integrated, clear view of his values and of his priorities, and when he is strong, then all of a sudden you've got one head of the church. Interesting little footnote in terms of the role of Clara Middlemas, the one woman in this drama that that a secretary strategically placed can have a major political influence at times. Someone who was not a member, but I guess a very strong supporter of Eddie, and she had her own little forum from which to interpret the views of President McKay. I thought another part of Mike's paper that was most interesting was the responses that Birchers would send in when there was a statement by the First Presidency or a statement by Elder Peterson in the Church News against the Birch Society, and then there would be these very strong militant objections. And I couldn't help as I was reading this paper, I didn't send a letter of support when they had that. That editorial in the Church News. Now, where are some of us when a policy is stated that we do support? Is it too easy to allow others sometimes to send letters of support or letters of objection and let those with fierce fanatical intensity perhaps be the only ones that church leaders hear from and so feel like, oh, we've got to step back. We went a little too far, like President McKay said on that one occasion. I think that it's interesting, as Mike reports, that President Benson feels vindicated at this time in his views, in that I also feel vindicated in terms of the fact that none of these leaders who were accused of these heinous, treasonous crimes against America have had the slightest bit of credible evidence presented to back that up, and instead it seems that they have been vindicated in their patriotic loyalty and in many of their policies. Finally, I just wanted to suggest that after all the sound and fury of these years, number one, that politically, Apostle Benson didn't have a very big impact. At the very peak of the Bircher political activity, we had, maybe 5% of those in certain counties who were active Birchers. Since then, even in what we consider hotbed areas, the percentage is much smaller than that. And that the great crisis of that was supposed to happen when President Benson came into office never happened. And while it could be partly because of diminished capacity or other reasons, there are many who say that particularly in the first years of the Benson administration, there was still a lot of coherence and a lot of power behind public appearances and such of President Benson. And I might suggest other reasons, looking back at the fears about President Joseph Fielding Smith, the fears about President Kimball, that one was going to be this great fire and brimstone and going to excommunicate right and left, and the other was going to talk about nothing but Indian homosexuals or whatever because of his background. And these things didn't happen either. That these people received the keys of prophecy and that it made an important difference. And I want to close with an appreciation of the thrust of President Benson's testimony since he has become prophet of the church. I have received even greater insight and comfort from the stress on the Book of Mormon and on Christ and Him crucified. And thank you for giving me a few minutes this afternoon.
Just looking at my watch, I've noticed we've got about 10 minutes for questions. If you would ask your questions clearly and in a thought-out manner, it would be appreciated. Address it to either Dr. Quinn or Dr. May. And I realize this may be kind of a situation of jumping up here to the microphone for both of you, but if you could come up to the microphone when called upon and repeat the question, it would be appreciated so we can get on the tape. And in 10 minutes, I'm just going to let us go. We'll ask questions right up to the last. So I'd like to thank everybody for being here.
Question was, does or did Apostle Benson's 1980 talk at BYU about 14 essentials and following the prophets, did that have anything to do with this controversy? It did, and I had a discussion of that and what the public reactions were to it and what some of the private reactions among the brethren were to it, but I didn't have time to present it. But it was a part of this controversy, and it was a late 80s development of a similar theme that had been rumbling through the church for the previous two decades. The first part of the question was, can I comment about whether there was an effort on President Benson's part to make one of his sons a special counselor when he became president of the church? My answer to that's really easy. I have no knowledge of such a development. Concerning sources, there are a number of manuscript diaries, letters, minutes that I've examined that relate to this. One thing that's really quite extraordinary, though, is how much was in the public domain, how much was in the newspaper accounts about this controversy for three decades. It's extraordinary how eager all of those involved were to talk publicly, including in conference sermons, about this issue. And that's one of the things that struck me as I was doing the research, was how candid everyone was. Everyone wasn't only brave, everyone was also candid during this period about this controversy. And so it's actually an easy one to document because it was so public. Yes? It's a distinction that he made and that others made, either particularly those who were trying to distance the John Birch Society from the church, made the distinction that he is wearing another hat. However, when he spoke at meetings sponsored by the John Birch Society, they always identified him as a member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. So there were a lot of political agendas here involved. And the John Birch Society had an agenda of aligning him as an apostle with the support he was giving to the John Birch Society. And Hubie Brown and others who were opposed to the John Birch Society did their best to say he's speaking as an individual. In his own view, though, I think it's fair to say, Ezra Taft Benson saw no difference between the principles of the gospel and the principles of the John Birch Society. He felt they both supported an eternal principle of freedom and the protection of God's chosen land, the United States of America. That's his view, and so I think even as he said, he was only speaking as a private citizen. That personal conviction has to also be taken into consideration, because he really saw this as a mission of divine origin. Somewhere in this area, yes.
President Benson's involvement with the John Birch Society increased after he
The question is, did Ezra Taft Benson's involvement with the John Birch Society increase after his son Reed Benson became a coordinator? Well, Reed Benson became a coordinator only a year after Ezra Taft Benson returned to Utah from service in Washington, D.C., and so the involvement in the John Birch Society increased, but the two events occurred so close to one another that it's not as though there was a five-year period when there was a little activity. It was the next year Reed Benson was a coordinator for the John Birch Society. So you're right that his Elder Benson's activity did increase, but Reed was appointed only a year after he returned to Utah. So I'm not sure that you can say that there was little significant activity before that appointment. Yes, toward the middle and the back. It's a different America. It's a different world. The question is, excuse me, I should have repeated the question. Given that, as I've said, Brother Benson saw no difference between the principles of the John Birch Society and the principles of the gospel, the question was, why has he not, since 1985, promoted the principles of the John Birch Society as church president? And my answer to that is, it's a different United States, it's a different world. Because when he became president of the church in 1985, it was Reagan's America. There was no significant liberal movement within the United States. It was a conservative counter-revolution that had worked. And America was conservative in ways in which Ezra Taft Benson in the 1960s could only have dreamed for, have hoped and prayed for, which he did, in fact. And so there was no need to speak. You know, he was speaking to the converted in 1985 onward, because the majority of young people who were his special concern in the 1960s, people in their 20s, college age, who he felt were being radicalized on college campuses, the 75% or more of students on college campuses defined themselves as conservative and as Reagan supporters. The battle had already been won. There was no need to campaign in that direction. And he has continued to speak in terms of freedom. He's continued to speak in terms that were not narrowly defined as a support of the John Birch Society, because the platform was already in place.
To that as well. As I look at the opinion data over the last, since the Reagan presidency, I certainly don't see the overwhelming victory for Reaganist principles among young Americans or others, even though young Americans did vote for Reagan in large numbers. I see a lower level of political knowledge, a lower level of political interest. Continuing, I guess what you'd call liberalism, on many social issues, and some conservatism on economic issues, and even that much support for President Reagan is now, with the current economic crisis, disintegrating fairly rapidly.
There was a woman in the center who had a question. Yes. The question is there a record concerning hiring policies during the 1960s, particularly regarding the political science department? There's, excuse me, with that issue, if I understand the question correctly, it's called Brigham Young University, a House of Faith, and that deals with a number of issues concerning the university, among them being hiring and academic freedom issues, and that book is also going through a updating, but it's a publication of signature books, and I guess that would address the question you had. Yes. The question was, did George Wallace, who was a candidate of a third party in 1968, ask President Benson, or then Apostle Benson, to be his vice presidential candidate, running mate? The answer is yes, he did. And President Benson presented that to David O. McKay, who vetoed it.
Thank you.